Welcome to Lessons from Losing, a new series from Awin where we speak to founders about the slip-ups, setbacks and struggles behind their success. Today, I'm joined by Kieran Dunn, CEO and co-founder of Genie Ventures, the business behind a portfolio of successful tech and digital businesses built over more than two decades. Now, building a business is never a straight line. Every challenge, setback and difficult decision leaves its mark, shaping not just the company you build, but the leader that you become. From taking calculated risks to navigating the realities of entrepreneurship over more than 20 years, this is Kieran's story. This is Lessons from Losing with Kieran Dunn.
You need to have that base covered, but you need to be doing something that you enjoy doing, you need something that's giving you satisfaction. I think that's what success is, is that feeling of, actually, I'm doing the right thing with my life. This is giving me meaning. This allows me to do the things I want to do. So yeah, I'm Kieran. I'm one of the co-founders of Genie Ventures. So we are a small group of companies. We are CSS called Genie Shopping. We are a broadband comparison website called Broadband Genie that's been around for like more than 20 years now. And we are an agency called Genie Goals that goes across paid search, paid social and affiliate management and influencer. So affiliate for us is a real key part of what we do across all three of those of those businesses. And I'm sure we might come onto some of this, but it's a channel that allows for or fosters innovation, but also I think it allows access to brands and merchants through the channel that would be harder to get otherwise. My role as co-founder has changed quite a lot. So I used to be the CEO of the business, and me and my fellow co-founder Paul changed it a bit a couple of years ago. So we structured the business slightly differently. And because we've grown over the years, our revenue this year will hopefully go over the £40 million mark for the first time. We very much split the business into three separate brands, each with its own CEO, which means that I now have this slightly spurious co-founder role, I would say this to anyone, is that I have the best job in the world because, you know, really the CEOs and the leadership teams and obviously the people at Coalface do all the real work. And I used to do real work, so it's not like I'm ashamed of this, but I just get to do the best bits. I get to do the interesting conversations, the planning, being the important meetings, the room where it happens, as they say in Hamilton, but without a lot of the stress that I used to have in my role. And we don't have any investors or anyone particularly to answer to apart from ourselves. So I have a great role.
So how long has the business in total been live for now, running for?
It depends how you measure it, but let's say since 2004, because that's when Broadband Genie went live for the first time. We really started running it properly as a business in 2008. And for the first few years, it was very much a day a week kind of business alongside another business that we had. And then we sort of put it all together in 2008. And created what is now Genie Ventures.
And what prompted you to create Broadband Genie originally? What was the spur?
It was created by a guy called Phil Wilkinson, who used to be a partner in the business, who was the original founder of Kelku in the UK. And at the time was working for NTL Telewest, and it was just when broadband was new. So, you know, we wanted to create a website that would help consumers understand and find broadband providers. And that's really where we came across affiliate as a way of as structuring commercial deals with providers.
And what about the name, Genie? What was the kind of...
Genie, helpful guide. I mean, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, but everything we certainly used to do, I used to write all the content for the website. And it was all written in this very, it's much better than this now. Everything is much better now that I don't touch it. But I used to write it in this very stylized, genie, colorful language. But the idea was always that my mum would be able to use the site. And she'd probably hate me saying that, but you know what I mean? It's the idea that we had to write everything. Broadband is quite a technical product, which actually is quite challenging in comparison. Like it's far smaller percentage of the market switches through comparison websites in broadband than say in energy or car insurance. And it's just because it's a technical product and people don't like thinking about it. So you have to be able to like talk about like megabits or whatever in a way that doesn't make people have to care about what a megabit is. You have to be able to translate it
But you kind of have to turn it into, you know, what does that mean for your personal experience at home in terms of your ability to like stream content or download things or
Do you need the, you know, the the terabit service that someone's offering, or do you just need something much, much cheaper? And there's obviously, you need to be able to understand your own needs and match. So really, Broadband Genie came from that sort of product-led idea of of a place that people could come and understand broadband and find the right broadband provider for them.
And what about the subsequent creation of those other sibling companies? What was the kind of intent there?
So I think probably we might come on to some business failures later on. But the three, I'd say, relatively successful brands we have now are very much three of many that didn't make it.
Many genies that didn't quite make it out of the lamp.
So we were encouraged by Broadband Genie, and we thought, well, we can do this in other areas. Mm. So we launched all kinds of things. Mm. We had various other comparison websites that I come onto. We had a couple of coffee businesses.
Oh, really?
At one point.
Okay.
Because we thought we wanted to get into like direct to consumer.
Okay, yeah.
Which was a good idea, but it turns out the direct to consumer is harder than like price comparison. So we I think what we thought with some element of truth was that we had a skill set, a way of attracting traffic and a way of helping consumers and adding value and a way of monetizing that, you know, commercially, be it through affiliate or direct relationships or whatever it is. So that we saw that as our essential skill, as opposed to say it just being about broadband specific. Mm. So we tried to take that to other areas, and they all had their own path. Mm. So what's now Genie Shopping, which is, you know, a really successful CSS, started off as a social shopping experience where people would upload their own products.
Oh, right.
And talk about them. Okay. And as you can imagine, like, there's been a lot of different versions of it between then and now, some of which, and again, we might come on to this later, was prompted by, you know, price comparison used to be a big thing, and then Google Shopping came along and essentially took price comparison away, and then the EC intervened, and it's going to come back again through CSS. So they've all evolved in many ways. Yeah. And Genie Goals, actually, the agency business really span out of the price comparison business originally, because we'd built a lot of technology that would manage bidding at scale on Google. Mm-hmm. Because in price comparison, you're managing millions of keywords, millions of products, millions of pages. But we got a bit fed up of the rates that people would pay price comparison, the retailers would pay price comparison websites, as opposed to, say, their own in-house PPC teams. So we thought, well, why don't we take some of this tech and offer it to an in-house team, and instead of collecting a 4% CPA, suddenly be on a 40% cost of sale target.
Yeah.
And again, that's changed a huge amount, and we no longer operate on that model, but that's where that came from. Yeah. So the business has really come from a combination of things, I think, a sort of attitude of always looking for something coming through and a kind of opportunistic seeing opportunities and following seams.
Yeah, if there's a thread through all of these businesses, it sounds like you're often responding to like changing market dynamics or consumer behaviors, and then trying to build businesses around that appetite as it evolves.
I think that's true. And I think with a particular talent as a business for doing that in areas where there's commercial value as well.
Well, obviously the kind of like a theme of this series of interviews with founders is to find out a bit more about the setbacks, the challenges, some of the failures that they've had. So I wanted to ask you just what is, like, would you say, looking back on this long career now as a founder of several businesses, like what's the single biggest failure or setback that you've experienced as a business leader?
So can I do this to people? So I have a philosophy degree for a long time, so I quite like concepts.
Okay.
And there's obviously a big difference between the concept of a setback and the concept of failure.
Yeah.
And I'll probably talk about this quite a lot, but I think anyone in business, or probably anyone in life, you have to tell yourself a story about failure that makes it okay.
It's salvageable.
And if you don't, you just crawl under a rock. So I'll come on to that. But I think setbacks are easier in some ways. So that, I think there are two, there's millions of minor setbacks like we all have. The two moments where I genuinely wanted to like crawl under the desk and think, oh God, is this how it ends? After all this work, is this how it ends? The first one was Google Panda in 2011, when the original Broadband Genie and some other stuff we were doing, all very SEO, all very organic traffic. And we had always been on the white hat side of the line. Mm-hmm. So we like anyone, you know, you try and gain an advantage on Google, but we weren't doing anything particularly bad. And then there's this massive shift in goalposts that really penalized price comparison websites. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just remember you just remember doing what I did in the morning, you know, go searching for broadband on Google. Are we still number one?
Yeah.
Like, and we're not on the first page, and just, you know, search for broadband deals and we're not, and just thinking, well, this is it. Is this the end of the business? And you have this horrible feeling, a part of that is because it's not in your control.
Yeah.
And the other moment that was like that was lockdown.
Right, okay.
Because again, like, it's easy. Like, there's this famous saying, isn't there, that history is kind of ruined because we know how it ends.
Mm.
And obviously we know how that ended now for our business. You know, we were fine ultimately. But at the time, we had broadband providers, we had retailers saying, well, we might be shutting our warehouse down. So we might just not be running activity.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just thinking, but no, we got that. What are we going to do? If there's no retail, if there's no one's selling broadband, then what? And obviously, actually, online retail did well. It's funny because some of the things we're now doing on Broadband Genie are almost going back to things we did before Panda, because Panda, for so long, scared the living daylights out of anyone that I think, in price comparison, everyone just cut their websites down to these very, very simple websites that didn't do a lot, because we're all scared that if we put the wrong kind of content live or put too many pages live, then Google would be, I know, you're abusing your domain strength. So it really went away from all the interesting, you know, user-centric stuff we used to do to just being, we'll just send people to a comparison site. And I think it took many years actually to overcome the fear of trying new things because you're just so scared that Google wouldn't like it. So in terms of failures, I mean, so feel free to pick me up on this, argue with me, but this goes back to storytelling, I think. So we're very lucky at Genie. We can be very self-indulgent, and we can try and have a really positive attitude to failure. I mean, it's obviously worth saying that no one likes failing, but I do think that if we all, you know, if we worried too much about our failures, then we wouldn't do anything at all. So we have to always have the attitude that, firstly, there's a sort of a comedy to failure. It can be funny to fail. And secondly, that there's an intentionality about failure. I think as long as you set out to do something, if you fail to achieve it, then actually genuinely you get somewhere that maybe wasn't where you meant to get to, but you know more than you did before. Now, I do appreciate that's me telling myself a story, because it allows us to explain our own failures without getting hung up on it. But it does mean that, in answering your question, it's quite difficult to really say that anything we've done is a failure that I regret. There's lots of things we've done that didn't work. But again, without wanting to get too like conceptual about it, I don't really know whether they're failures, because if we hadn't done them, we wouldn't be where we are.
Are there any that like particularly stand out? One of the things that we've been asking the guests that have come into the studio has been around where they've had things that they were convinced it was going to be a success. Like, this is a product or a strategy or an initiative that was absolutely, you know, odds on to succeed. And for whatever reason, it just didn't take, it didn't land, and it ended up being something they had to let go of.
A lot of them are quite funny, our failures. So, I mean, there was a comparison website that I invested huge amounts of time on, writing content, using all the apps and tools that were out there already, building what we thought was a really good idea. And that was an online bingo comparison website.
Okay.
Bingo Genie.
Of course.
And I
basically, any of your ideas that are going to be, there's going to be a genie on the end.
That didn't work. That was hilarious. We were relatively successful. We actually stopped doing this before COVID, but we had an office space finding website. And that originally started off as a really cool desk space sharing website, where if you had spare desk space in your office, you could list it. Because we used to do that, and the only place that you could list it was Gumtree, and that was really inefficient. So we thought, we could make a really cool website where people list their desks. And we put quite a lot of time and effort and money into it. We got some amazing coverage. We were on the BBC Working Lunch programme.
Oh, really?
We were covered in the FT and the Guardian. People loved it.
Yeah.
But it just turned out to be a terrible commercial idea. Because although people liked the idea, like, the people with spare desks in their office are all small design agencies, and they don't pay for anything. But again, that ended up evolving into a relatively successful commercial website, because it turned out that there are serviced office providers and co-working companies where actually they do have budgets and they will spend money. And it wasn't the original idea for the website, but we got there. Like I said, there's a comedy element to failure as well, which, and I don't want to overdo this because I want people to lose confidence in Genie, but one of the benefits of our model is that we can make mistakes, which is, I guess, a kind of failure, and it'd be okay because it's our money. So we frequently lose large amounts of money running campaigns on Google because we've done something like accidentally targeted America rather than the UK. Yeah. But it's our own money. It's not our customers' money. Yeah. We won at the PMAs last year, which was 2025. Okay. If my memory is correct.
That's correct. Yeah.
We won the Publisher of the Year and the Performance Marketing Team of the Year.
Yeah.
And that evening, as we sat there, we lost about 40 grand on a campaign that where we just got it wrong. There was some tracking had gone wrong. We lost a bit of control.
Yeah.
And we came out of it thinking, we are the only company in this room that could have done that.
Yeah.
That could have this amazing night. Yeah. We're in front of the whole industry being paraded as this really successful performance marketing business.
Yeah.
We've just lost 40 grand while we're doing it. Again, the comedy to it was, it's our money.
Yeah.
You know, we've made that money. Yeah. We can lose that money. We're not using customers' money. We don't have investors.
Yeah.
So we can just, to a certain extent, shrug our shoulders and say,
yeah,
you know, obviously, being serious, we need to learn from this. We need to do things to stop it happening again.
Yeah.
But there's no point in beating ourselves up about it. And that helps us deal with it.
Yeah.
But it also, I think, helps, you know, we have an amazing team with incredible individuals. And I think they need that from us as well.
Yeah.
They need to know that they're not going to get the book thrown at them for something that probably isn't their fault.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to just pass down.
And I guess, like, if you were to have a culture like that, then it prevents that kind of ambition for innovation, trying new things. It, you know, it gives people a sense of, like, you know, I'm not going to try to do anything different because otherwise there are going to be repercussions that I don't really want to experience.
It's a really hard balance to strike, isn't it? Because you don't want, like, forget the team, you know, just us ourselves. You don't want to have a laissez-faire attitude I've lost some money, doesn't matter, because it does matter. But I think when you're trying to do something with intentionality and it goes wrong, even quite spectacularly wrong like that, you have to kind of think, well, at least we tried, and, you know, we just have to laugh it off.
It's
that balance between taking it seriously and not taking it too seriously,
because
you do hear, you know, there's some awful workplace cultures around, aren't there, where leadership teams just pass pressure down, and anything that goes wrong, people get hauled over the coals for it. And I'm sure there's a time and a place for that, but it's no point doing it for the sake of it.
Yeah.
If it's a simple mistake, and I've made, I'm sure, many more simple mistakes with bidding and SEO and whatever else as anyone else in my team has. Yeah. So I'd be a hypocrite if I started saying, I can't believe we've done this. Like it's a culture and an attitude, I think. Yeah. And I do think that ends up making us a lot more money than it loses us.
Yeah.
Our attitude would say, you know, if we stick to something really simple like Google campaigns, if we do accidentally blow a load of money on Google, which happens a lot, Google's always the winner in these situations. And to be honest, our customer is often the winner because they benefit from the volume.
Yeah.
We'd always have the attitude, we'll make it back.
Yeah.
We'll learn something. Our competitors are going to make these mistakes and they're going to be scared and go away.
Yeah.
And we're not going to go away.
Yeah.
There's parts of the business where we haven't given up when it hasn't been going well, which is a slightly different thing. But if I go, you know, talk about setbacks earlier on, I mentioned price comparison, the rise of Google Shopping. You know, the rise of Google Shopping was a devastating blow to the price comparison, the retail price comparison industry in the UK and across Europe, because not only did Google, and I'm saying this, you know, this isn't me saying this, this is the European Court judgment that said this. Google put their own product at the top of the SERPs, but they relegated competitive products through things like Panda as well. And, you know, it decimated our retail price comparison business. And a lot of people just gave up. But we kept in there because we could still see ways of making it work, albeit at a smaller scale. And we had a certain faith that we would, this was stuff we were good at, and we would find a way. And it meant that when Google launched its CSS program, we were then incredibly well-placed because we had built all this technology and we had the retailer relationships to jump on that and be really early. You know, we were one of the original CSSs, and now we are one of the biggest CSSs in Europe.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is because we were in that situation where it was, you know, externally failing. And I think if we'd had investors or, you know, VC backers or anything like that, they would have looked at it and said, you've got to shut this down.
Yeah.
And we had plenty of people telling us to shut it down.
Yeah.
Say, no, shut that down, focus on... You know, stop spreading your efforts, focus on one thing. And we always thought, no, we're not going to do that because we sort of believe in this market and we believe in ourselves.
What is it? What is that belief that you had at the time? Do you remember, like, what, you know, you must have had doubts at moments and thinking, like, oh, I don't know if I'm making the right decision here. Maybe we should just cancel it and kind of wind it up.
To be honest, it's probably like a bloody mindedness, if that's the right word. I think We went through a spell of trying to think maybe a bit too deeply about what kind of business we wanted to be, because we had Broadband Genie, which is, you know, is a really, really, really well-established consumer brand. And we were launching these other things, and we spoke to a few external external advisors, and everyone told us the same thing. Everyone said, this isn't the way a successful business grows. You need to focus all your efforts on one thing, you know, be the best at one thing, really grow, grow, grow. And we nearly did that. And whenever we sat down, we just thought to ourselves, we don't actually want to do that. That's not us. What we're about is trying things and doing interesting things and pushing forward on lots of fronts. And actually that has been the thing, I think, that's brought meaning to our lives. But actually saved us so many times, because if we had just put our efforts into one thing, I mean, it doesn't mean I'm right. Maybe if we put all our efforts into one brand, it would be the biggest brand in the world right now. But I don't think so. I think it suited us as individuals to be working across different things, because we felt we were learning more. We were failing more. Again, I'll put my positive spin on that as failure as learning. And it meant that we had that resilience. So that in that price comparison, retail price comparison example, if we didn't have a successful broadband comparison website and at that point a fast growing agency, we wouldn't have had the luxury of being able to be self-indulgent. Whereas competitors of ours, that was all they did. They had no choice. They had to shut down or go and do something else because they couldn't survive.
I guess that diversification you've got within the group kind of gives you that strength to be able to be more resilient in those movements.
But it is actually one of the things I think we struggle with, and I struggle with, is knowing when to stop. Because it is easy to look back at the stuff that worked and you didn't stop and go, that's work. That shows how much more resilient we are than other people. We stick at things in the long term. We do the right thing and it works. But you only know that with, you know, with hindsight.
Survivorship bias in a way.
And obviously there are plenty of other things that we did stop doing eventually. But I find that personally really hard to know, because you can get carried away, I think, by your own belief that if we just keep sticking at this, we will find a way, because we know there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Now, you're obviously a co-founder alongside your other kind of peers there. And but there must be moments, I guess, where, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs and founders find that they're having to make big decisions for the organization. You've got a lot of people working for you, you know, rely on you for their income, for their, you know, professional development, etc. Does it ever get quite lonely sometimes when you are kind of like bearing that responsibility?
I don't know. I don't know about examples, but there's definitely principles that we talk about a lot at Genie. So obviously this podcast is about failure. We do talk a lot about failure in the sense of intentionality. So we like to try and go about a new initiative, a new campaign, a new, what's another word for initiative or campaign? A new project. I should have said this at the start. The only kind of failure that really, really, really hurts is when you have to let people go. And, you know, we've been going a long time. I think we've been through this maybe 3 or 4 times. We've had to let a few people go. And that is horrible, because that's a kind of failure where you're affecting other people's lives and the people that you care about. And, you know, we're a lot bigger than we were, but we're still a small business, really. We're about 70 people. So you know everyone. And you rate everyone. You genuinely, I don't think I'm a hugely empathetic person, but I do care about people. And you say that isn't a failure you can laugh off. There's no comedy to that. That is just a kind of a horrible feeling inside. And again, the only positive you can draw from that is you don't want to put yourself in that situation again.
Has there been anything that's been helpful in terms of, you know, doing that a few times and kind of getting a sense of like, this is the right way to do it. This is the right way to approach it.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things there. I think we have some people in our organization who were let go previously in their careers by maybe big corporates and had horrendous experiences. And so we were quite well placed to try and put processes together where no one wants to lose their role. But I think we've genuinely tried to make the experience as kind as it can be. And, you know, I'm always blown away by people when they do leave, turning around and saying really nice things about us, as opposed to hating us, and sometimes you do just want to punch you in the face, so it'd make you feel better. In terms of that kind of decision, again, that balance between how long do you leave it before admitting that it's a failure, particularly when it affects roles, versus, you know, how long do you just push on? I think that's a reason why it's always really important to us that we're diversified, is because we always want to be making those decisions from a position of strength, where we're not making decisions like on existential threat. Like it's not panicky. so we can make kind of rational decisions rather than emotional decisions.
Yeah.
And we can do it from a position that as a group, we have financial strength, financial resilience, and we can do the right thing by the people, but also by the business, put the right things in place and not have some kind of like, you know, panicky layoffs and fire sales and that kind of stuff.
And where your hand is being forced kind of against your own kind of intentions.
Yeah. And that's just, again, we're very lucky that we're, it's not a piece of advice you can give to someone. Yeah. Go and set up three businesses that are quite successful because that gives you more resilience. But for me, that's just a huge weight off my mind.
Yeah. What was it that you'd say that you know now as a leader that you really wish that you'd understood earlier in your career? What's been something that you've taken with you?
Right. So, so you should pick me up now if I sound overly cheesy.
Okay.
But there is nothing that I would go and tell myself.
Okay.
And this isn't like a Back to the Future type thing.
Yeah.
Because the question you've asked me is a question that appears a lot, isn't it? With people way more successful than me. What would you tell you? And there's always a smart answer. I would tell myself this, that, or the other. But I think we underestimate the power of naivety.
Mm.
And we wouldn't have done the things that we did if we knew these things. Like you'd be crazy to start a business.
Yeah.
Like 85% of all businesses fail in the first 12 months, whatever the made up stat is. You know, and the older you get, the more things you know that don't work.
Mm.
And the thing that makes you do it in the first place is you have this naivety that you're arrogance, maybe, if that's the right word, that it doesn't work for them, but it'll work for us.
Yeah.
And I think the older you get, that goes a bit.
Yeah.
So I think if I went back to myself and tried to teach myself any lessons, firstly, my young self wouldn't listen to me.
Yeah.
They'd be like, what do you know?
Yeah.
What do you know? You're old. And secondly, if they did listen to me, that would be a mistake.
Yeah.
I can't think of any, there's no massive thing that I feel we've missed out on.
Yeah.
That if we just known, except again, in the Back to Future sense of, which exact match domain names to buy in 2004.
That'll be handy.
Or, you know, who won the Grand National or whatever. But that doesn't count, does it? I don't know. I think in terms of like business wisdom, you're better off with naivety than wisdom when you're young, aren't you?
What advice would you give to somebody that's thinking about starting a business today? And do you think that advice you would give them is maybe different today than it would have been maybe 20 years ago?
No, I don't think advice would be different because I think it's by nature, you know, starting a business or so many different kinds of businesses, it's general. I don't think it changes. I think for me, I would only give someone advice if they really wanted advice because most of what I've got to say is only going to be relevant to Genie.
Yeah.
But I think it ties in with what we've talked about actually around failure. So for me, I think the biggest thing that I would suggest to someone is that they need to build in some resilience from the start.
Mm.
So people have very strong dreams about the business they want to start. And one day they will start the business and then they do and they quit their job and they start the business they've always wanted to do and it doesn't work and it's a disaster. I would, for most people, again, this is the exception is maybe startups, but even then there's a version of this. For most people, it doesn't feel like the right thing to do to me, but the right thing to do is to have some money coming in, start your business, because a bit like I was saying before, you might say my business is going to get me from A to B, but it's not. It's going to get them from A to somewhere else, to D or to E or something. It's not going to be what they think it's going to be. And you need some resilience built in. You need to have the ability to not make panicky decisions, to not say, oh God, I'm running out of money next month. Yeah. You know, if you've got, again, this is going to be, I don't know, it's a part-time job or consultancy or whatever. But for us, it was a kind of sort of agency type model. As we were building Broadband Genie, we were also running other people's websites for them, managing the content, charging monthly fees. So we could have a terrible month, but we'd still be able to pay our rent eat. Whereas if everything was on that, imagine the pressure. And I think people put themselves in that situation because they think that's a healthy thing to do. It's like, I'll make it so important that means I'll give it everything.
Mm.
But if you make it so important that you're worried about paying your rent, I'm not convinced you're going to make the best decisions because you need a bit of, a bit of something, don't you? A bit of ability to do some magic and to be creative and to be interesting. Whereas if it's, everyone's in business for money, ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, we say at Genie, we're in business to make some money, to make an impact and to have some fun.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not sure whether those three principles apply to everyone, but it can't just be about money. If money is the only thing, then the pressure is too much, I think. So I think I've laboured that point a bit, but the advice I would give to people is always around that. I think it'd more be around, your business idea sounds amazing. I can't judge it. Don't know anything about what you do. But like, what else are you doing that's going to sustain you during that period of time?
I think there is a kind of slightly toxic fetishization of that hustle bro startup culture. Particularly, you see a lot of it online, on LinkedIn, etc. And I think that that can maybe lead people into assuming that it has to be that way. But obviously, there are all sorts of paths to success.
I agree. I think like startup culture is obviously an amazing thing and contributes hugely to innovation, but it creates, I suppose, in the same way as you might have with famous models, it creates an illusion of what running a business is like. And the vast majority of businesses aren't like that. They're like my mum and dad's businesses. Their sleeves rolled up in the stock room as the business owner and founder, doing the stuff that no one else wants to do because you don't want to pay them to do it. Yeah. So, you know, it's all cliche, but you're the person washing the dishes. You're the person like hoovering the floor. You're the person packing all the mail, all that. That's what starting a business is like. And you've got to enjoy doing that. You can't be sucked in by the sort of the glamour side of it, I don't think. Yeah.
But we talked a lot about, you know, losses, mistakes, failures, setbacks, etc. But I wanted to end on a slightly more positive note, I guess, and ask you about what does winning actually mean to you today? Like, what does success look like?
Yeah, that's a much harder question to answer. So I think this definitely changes over the years. Because I think when you're starting a business, you see whatever, you know, famous startups, you see people selling businesses for large amounts of money. And that's the kind of stuff in the back of your mind that you're thinking, oh, like one day, you know, it could be me. I think the wiser you get, well, no, I don't know if this is objecting, this is just me too. I'll just talk about myself. I think as I've gone through that, I've got much less interest in that kind of stuff. I think what you realize, and this I'm sure is the same with any job, is it is all about the meaning it brings to your life. And that's quite, I don't even know if that means anything, but there's a sense in which you know that you're living a meaningful life. You know that there's a purpose to your life, you're motivated, there's that kind of Daniel Pink concept, isn't there, about money. Basically, as long as you're getting enough money to do what you want to do, that's actually, that takes away the money drive to a certain extent. But so you need to have that base covered. But you need to be doing something that you enjoy doing, and something that's giving you satisfaction. I think that's what success is.
Yeah.
Is that feeling of actually I'm doing the right thing with my life. This is giving me meaning. This allows me to do the things I want to do at work, to express myself, to, you know, to try things, to fail with a safety cushion. Or to, you know, occasionally succeed and have everyone go, wow, that's amazing. But also, you know, like I've got four kids. I've been coaching a lot of football over the last few years. I like doing lots of other stuff. I've got an amazing partner. Yeah. So it's all part of life. And it's for me, you know, work-life balance isn't really a thing because it's all part of the same thing. And I think success is all about meaning. This sounds really cheesy, doesn't it?
No.
So I should just say, I want to buy a Ferrari and that'll be when I'm successful.
We're done.
And anything less than that is a failure.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, what does success look like in like 3 years' time? But I guess it's the Ferrari answer at that point. So
I think, again, like, I think those three things I mentioned before, and we genuinely talk about this at Genie, if we've got the staff together, as long as we are making some money, and that's, you know, the business, all the individuals in the business, us as the co-founders, as long as we're making an impact, and then that could be anything. To someone, that's, you know, saving the world. To someone else, that's creating a product that is different to what's out there. It's very self-defined. As long as you feel like you're making an impact, you're leaving a dent in the world, and having some fun, you know, which doesn't mean just like silly fun, but just enjoying yourself. You know, like, I mean, we all have to go to work every day. And in this country at this year, and this might all change, for a lot of us, we have the luxury that to a certain extent we can choose what we do. You know, we apply for jobs, we choose sectors we want to work in. And that is a luxury. And if you kind of get up, you know, and work 8 hours a day and think about it outside work, you've got to be doing something that you at some level enjoy. And that doesn't mean you have to enjoy every single minute of it. Everyone's got boring stuff, everyone's got hard stuff. But when you take that step back, am I, you know, so we say to everyone who starts in the business, you know, after 3 months at Genie, you need to be that person who's sitting in the pub or whatever with your friends, boring them to death by saying, oh my God, I'm loving, you know, the people I'm working with, the stuff I'm working on. It's really great. And their friends going, we wish I had that. That's, you've got to have that. Otherwise, what's the point? So those. So in 3 years, it's the same answer as now, really. If someone said in 3 years' time, you're going to be making an impact, making some money, having fun, I'd be
boring your friends down the pub about how good your job is.
Exactly. Yeah. So boring people on podcasts. Yeah.
That's all for this episode of Lessons from Losing. Next time, I'll be joined by Ray Wright, co-founder and chief commercial officer of YouFurnish, to explore the unique challenges of building a business with your life partner and how one everyday frustration became the foundation for a fast-growing technology company. If you've enjoyed listening, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the rest of the series. And if you'd like to watch the full video interviews, just head over to Awin's YouTube channel. Until next time, thanks for listening and join me again for another Lesson from Losing.